Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we mark the annual celebration of love, Valentine's Day, and we thought it appropriate to investigate the history of that institution which we like to think is built on love, namely marriage. As our guest points out in her recent book on the subject, however, throughout most of history, marriage was not a relationship based on love between husband and wife, but rather an institution devoted to acquiring in-laws and enhancing a family's labor force. We'll explore how all of that changed with Stephanie Kuntz, the author of Marriage, A History, From Obedience to Intimacy to How Love Conquered Marriage. Fiona Beatty will join us after that to tell us about a site where you can learn more about the history of Valentine's Day cards. And Michael Farquhar will offer us the eighth in his 10-part series of readings from his book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds. But first, as we do each week, let's look at some items of historical interest in the news you may have missed. A letter of a poet written over 200 years ago, now in the possession of Swan Galleries in New York, was written by Phyllis Wheatley, a Boston slave and the author of the first book of poetry published by an African American. Wheatley wrote the letter on February 14, 1776, to her friend Ober Tanner, a slave in Newport, Rhode Island. Wheatley was born about 1754 in Africa. She was captured in Senegal in 1761, put on the slave ship Phyllis, from which she got her first name, and sold to the ship's owner, John Wheatley, which provided her surname. Her owner treated her comparatively well. She was not only taught to read and write, but also provided the opportunity to study Latin, mythology, ancient history, and classical literature. And in 1765, she began to write poetry. In 1767, she published her first poem in the Newport Mercury. In 1773, Wheatley accompanied her master's son, Nathaniel, to London, where they arranged for the publication of her book of poems, poems on various subjects, religious and moral. Her letter to Tanner, whom Wheatley met in the 1760s while the Wheatley family summered in Newport, is one of eight known letters she wrote to her friend. None of his to her has survived. When we return, Lena Place talks about marriage with her guest, Stephanie Kuntz. Some of our listeners will recall Stephanie Kuntz's previous book, The Way We Never Were, and how it changed our way of thinking about the family. Her new book is Shattering the Myth of a Golden Age of Traditional Marriage. Kuntz recently joined Talking History's Lena Place to discuss her conclusions.
Love and marriage, inseparably linked, two halves of the whole, two sides of the same coin. Well, maybe, and only fairly recently, according to our guest today. Stephanie Kuntz is the author of Marriage, A History, From Obedience to Intimacy, or How Love Conquered Marriage, a rich account of the institution about which everyone has an opinion, but, as she makes clear, few of us really understand. Professor Kuntz is the Director of Research and Public Education at the Council on Contemporary Families and teaches history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She has written extensively about marriage and family. Welcome, Stephanie.
My pleasure.
Early in your book, you state that historically, marriage has been first and foremost a social invention, serving the needs of society at any given time. Could you explain a little more what you mean by that term, social invention?
Well, many people seem to assume that marriage is something that's embedded in our genes or our biology. Certainly, the process of mating and reproduction and attraction are biological, and of course, in many cases, those get translated into marriage. But what's historically unique and what's different and unique to human beings about marriage is that not all mated relationships count as marriage, and there are many societies in which you can marry someone with whom you don't even mate. And there are these tremendously elaborate social rules about who can marry whom and how marriage works, what obligations it entails, and what privileges it gives. And those variations are so immense that the only reasonable conclusion is that these are socially mandated rules, not biologically mandated ones.
That vary from culture to culture?
Yes. When you talk about, you know, oh, marriage has always been between one man and one woman, not at all. In fact, a more commonly preferred marriage form through the ages was polygamy, one man, many women. There were even marriages of one woman and many men, or ghost marriages, where you might be married to the deceased daughter or son of another family.
You talk at some length about the importance of marriage in the past as being a process of joining groups or family units rather than individuals.
Yes, for me, I think this is one of the more interesting things to get beyond the debate that people have had for years. Was marriage invented to protect women? Some people argue that women needed men to protect them from predators and hunt meat for them. And then in the 1970s, feminist researchers noted that, in fact, in many hunting and gathering societies, women bring home the bulk of the food, and that men use marriage to privatize the labor of women. But the more I've studied it, the more I've come to believe that marriage was not about the relationship between the individual man and woman at all. It was a way of creating in-laws. It was a way of turning strangers into relatives. It was a way of making connections. There are many societies that have words such as the Anglo-Saxon word for wives, peace weavers. There are other cultures who say they are our enemies, we marry them. Or the Maori say that's the best way to make a link between different groups. So that, I think that marriage in its origin was a way of making links between groups. And that's very distinct from mating, which is between two individuals.
I confess I was a bit startled by your line that since the dawn of civilization, getting in-laws has been one of marriage's most important functions.
Well, that's one of the fun ironies. Today, of course, we think that, oh, wouldn't it be great to escape the in-laws? You know, we have all these movies about the monster in-law and all that. And in fact, for many couples, the relationship between those two as individuals has been improved by the fact that in-laws no longer dictate who gets to marry who and get to intervene. But in fact, historically, the thing that kept marriage stable through the ages was that it really was about the creation of in-laws. In very simple band-level societies, it was, as I said, a way of making alliances between groups. But once you get complex societies with a lot of socio and economic stratification, then, of course, you get parents and relatives only wanting to get their kids allied with certain groups, you know, hopefully ones with higher status and wealth. And that's when marriage turns into, as I found, a hotbed of intrigue as people schemed and maneuvered to get better marriages, and young people were forced into the maneuvering of their parents or sometimes wholeheartedly embraced it on their own.
So marriage was often, at least I think from a close reading of your book with the middle and upper classes, a political act then, right?
Oh, absolutely. It was the way that the upper classes concluded military alliances, made peace treaties, developed political influential relations in foreign ports or at home. It was a way of extending your political and economic connections. Some historians think that only the lower classes had the luxury of marrying for love, but I don't think even the lower classes did it for love. Through most of history, marriage was an economic and political institution, and even in the peasants and working classes, you couldn't run a farm or a business by yourself, and it was more important to marry someone who would fit in with the neighbors and who would be a good work partner than someone who you had this irrational attraction to called love.
And you talk about that a lot, the extent to which commentators remarked that love could really be rather dangerous, something that was not desired in an appropriate relationship.
Absolutely. That was really fun to read and somewhat surprising, even though we know that there were arranged marriages of the past, how unanimous different cultures were all around the world for thousands of years that love is a very bad reason to get married. Some cultures believed that love could only exist outside of marriage, or some groups in different cultures, for example, the medieval aristocracy said true love could only exist in an adulterous affair. Others believed that you should learn to love after you got married, but they all agreed that marrying for love, falling in love without permission, basically, was a very bad thing. It's an irrational thing, it's a self-indulgent thing, and it's socially irresponsible.
Keep going with that. What makes love such a dangerous basis for a relationship? What are going to be the terrible consequences of a love match?
Well, for thousands of years, marriage was the way that people concluded peace treaties, made business deals, developed working partnerships, expanded the family labor force. And if you made those choices of who to marry on the basis of love, you might end up getting people that you didn't want to get married. And for thousands of years, marriage was a privilege, not a right. It's really only in the 20th century that we've come to think of marriage as an individual right. And so there were many people who were not allowed to marry at all, some who were not allowed to marry people of different classes, and your parents wanted to make sure that you married someone that would fit in with their needs as a family. So falling in love would threaten it. That's why all the love stories through the ages are not sort of the chick flick happy endings or the sitcoms that we have today, but they were tragedies, because marriage was very often the unhappy ending to a love affair, as one or another was forced to marry someone else.
I have to admit, I was a little disappointed by your account of Antony and Cleopatra. Not exactly the passionate romance that we've been led to believe, was it?
Oh, my goodness. Incest, murder, political intrigue, ambition, it's all there. It would make modern tabloids look absolutely tame in comparison. True love, it definitely was not.
I was intrigued by your discussion about the impact of Christianity on marriage. It seemed as though the values of what was then the new religion offered one message about marriage, but the institutional needs of the early church promoted some very different attitudes and expectations about marriage. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, there were huge changes in the role of Christianity and its attitudes toward marriage, but Christianity developed as a millennial religion. It expected the second coming, and that was the most important priority. So Jesus says it many times, variations on, if you don't come to me and hate your father, your mother, your husband, your wife, and put me first, then you're not being really true to God. And that became integrated with the monastic tradition and suspicion of sexuality, so that the Catholic Church in its early days was actually very suspicious of marriage. In the 6th century, Pope Gregory the Great said, marriage isn't in and of itself sinful, but if you're married, you're going to engage in these carnal acts, and that can't be without blame. The way that the medieval church painters showed how much somebody was blessed was by how many sheaves of wheat they carried. And so in pictures you get the virgin, who is loaded down with sheaves of wheat. After her comes the widow, because she at least has been removed from this carnal state. And finally, underneath her comes the respectably married wife. So you had a very interesting paradox in the Catholic Church. You had this suspicion of marriage and this idealization of virginity. But at the same time, the Catholic Church took the position, and this is quite rare, that although you ought to be guided by your parents and you really ought to marry according to family and social pressures, they took the position that if a man and woman had exchanged words of consent, you know, out by the woodpile, underneath the apple tree, anywhere, if they claimed that they had exchanged words of consent, then they were legally married. So the Catholic Church gave an escape clause to young people who did want to defy their parents. Not that many took advantage of it, but it was there. And one interesting paradox is that when Protestantism came along, the Protestants valued marriage as an institution more than the Catholics originally did, but they were much stricter about dissolving marriages that had not been entered into with parental approval. And in fact, they often dissolved marriages even when they were kids, leading to, you know, making these kids illegitimate. Very strict. You had to have parental approval.
And then, about 150 years ago, as you described, the seeds of change, expectations for marriage became very different, particularly in Western Europe and America. What was happening that caused the whole form, the whole nature of marriage to change?
Well, there was a very gradual change that you can see from the 16th century and even some hints from the 14th century on, romanticizing the marital relations in some classes and groups of Western Europe and European society. But the real sea change doesn't occur until the late late 18th century, and with the influence of two kinds of things working in interaction. One is the spread of wage labor, the notion of contract, on the first place that it did allow individuals who wanted to marry to leave to get a job, to accumulate money through work rather than waiting for a dowry or to inherit a piece of land. But perhaps even more important ideologically was the influence of the Enlightenment, which said that the state and the older generation should not dictate to the younger generation. And all these and many other factors came together in the late 18th century to create a major change in the ideas about what marriage should be about. First of all, there was a new emphasis on people, individuals being able to choose their own mates and to be able to choose it on the basis of love. As the American Revolution put it, the pursuit of happiness was a new value, and young people were allowed to put this into the number of motives that they had for getting married, and in fact it began to be romanticized as a reason for getting married. And of course, what was interesting was that conservatives of the day, defenders of what was then the traditional family, the traditional arranged marriage, were absolutely horrified. They said, basically, that love was going to be the death of marriage.
And yet, even though people were allowed to make their own choices, it was not an egalitarian relationship, was it? The role, the authoritarian role of the husband remained pretty clear-cut throughout the 19th century and well into the 20th, as you describe it.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And that, in fact, is why the traditionalists' warning that love would be the death of marriage were very premature. What happened was, as soon as you did have the idea that marriage should be about love, you got the demand that people should have the right to divorce if there was no love. You got the issue raised, and then it was really about poor people rather than about gays and lesbians. What do we do about people who say they love each other? Shouldn't they have the right to marry for love, since this is an important value? And you also got a challenge to the authority relations that had previously dominated marriage and made marriage, you know, that women were totally subordinate to their husband. But these ideas didn't play themselves out in reality, because in economic terms, legally, socially, women remained dependent on men. You know, it was men who were able to embrace the love match more than women were. They had to ask themselves, can I marry someone who supports me? You also had very poor birth control, and of course the doctrine of illegitimacy, which basically contradicted the early meaning of marriage and turned relatives into strangers. Huge penalties if you were not married and had children out of wedlock. All of these things, along with the continued coercive power of local elites that as late as the 1950s allowed people to deny bank loans or promotions to men who were not married by a particular age, who were divorced. All of these things stood in the way of the inherent radicalism of the love match. And it was only in the 20th century, in fact the late 20th century, that most people began to be able to totally act on the ideals of the love match. And at that point we began to see some of the destabilization that opponents had predicted as early as the 18th century.
We have time for one more question. Your book concludes with what I think, possibly with a bit of tongue-in-cheek, you refer to as the golden age of marriage in the 1950s, that Ossie and Harriet world where the husband was breadwinner, wife was stay-at-home mother and homemaker. And as you point out, that really only lasted for a long decade, about 17 years. Why has that become so firmly entrenched in today's image of what a right, normal, traditional marriage should be?
Well, that image had been in the making for about 150 years. I've now concluded that this was an ideal that had longer roots than I initially thought of in my earlier works. But it was not until the 1950s that a substantial majority of people could live by it. And it was a golden age of marriage in the sense of marriage as an institution. More people married than ever before. The extending lifespans and the lower rates of divorce meant that more people stayed married. Marriage was the way that people organized their lives, and the male breadwinner family looked like a tremendous asset to people who had had to scrabble for a living and had to do child labor for most of their life. We look back at that now, and we think of it as this golden age of stability in relationships, and I think we make a big mistake in confusing the stability of a relationship with an institution. The 1950s was a time when it was certainly much easier because of economic and political support systems to support a family on the wages of one earner. But those relationships were seldom the kind of relationships most of us dream about today, influenced as we are with ideas about equality and intimacy between husband and wife. And in fact, you know, we talk a lot about, was it the radicals of the 60s who destroyed those 1950s marriages, or was it the economic distress of the 1970s and 80s? Well, in fact, I think the seeds of it were built in. There were polls taken at the very end of the 1950s that showed that women in 1950s families, even the ones who said they were quite happy in their own marriages, definitively said, 90% of them said, we don't want our daughters to do this. We want our daughters to have a job first. We want them to delay marriage. So one answer is that as soon as we got into these stable marriages, people began to see that, in fact, they weren't fulfilling some of their needs for true equal intimacy. And that's been the problem ever since. I think that marriages today have become much more fulfilling than marriages of the 50s, than couples of the past would ever have dreamed of. But the same things that have made them fulfilling have made them more optional and more fragile.
Well, thank you. Marriage, that most complex of institutions, fragile, shaped by myriad circumstances and yet enduring. We've been talking with Stephanie Kuntz, author of Marriage, A History. This is Talking History.
Continuing our celebration of Valentine's Day, Fiona Beatty joins us now to tell you about a virtual site devoted to the history of postcards and greeting cards, including the Valentine's Day card.
Many of us will send and receive Valentine's cards this week, and the practice has quite a history that is well explained and illustrated at the Postcard and Greeting Card Museum, a virtual museum with an extensive online collection of digitized images of historical cards arranged in galleries with over 900 exhibits, timelines, biographies of card designers, histories of greeting card companies from all over the world, and much more. Arranged by occasion, Valentine's Day, Christmas, New Year's Day, and so on, each gallery provides an overview and history along with digitized images of cards made for the occasion. Did you know that in the Middle Ages, lovers said or sang their Valentines, but by the 1400s, people began to put pen to paper? Or that the British Museum holds the oldest greeting card, a Valentine's card dating to the 1400s, or that factory-made cards made their appearance in the 1800s. The highlight of the extensive collection of rare and interesting Valentine's cards is a rare, intricate, and exquisite paper lace card manufactured in 1875 by Esther Howland, who was among the first to print Valentine's cards in America. But a close competitor must be the mechanical cut-out card from 1936, depicting a boy beating a drum with the greeting, "My heart beats for you, my Valentine." Apparently, the boy's arms move to beat the drum as he marches. To view this remarkable collection and to learn more about the history of greeting cards, go to emotionscards.com and click on Postcard and Greeting Card Museum. You will not be disappointed.
And finally, as promised, Michael Farquhar is back for part 8 in his 10-part series of readings from his new book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds. This week he reads from part 8 of his book, The Great Pretenders, and from a chapter he has titled Queen Wannabe.
The allure of royalty must have been pretty potent for those close enough to observe firsthand the pampered luxury and fawning deference accorded to monarchs and their families. Such was the case with Sarah Wilson, a young maid in the service of Britain's Queen Charlotte, consort of King George III. The aura of majesty was apparently so intoxicating to the ambitious girl that she wanted a piece of it for herself. Her quest would eventually lead her to the American colonies, where she reinvented herself as a member of the royal family, who in fact never existed. But that's getting ahead of the story. At first, all Sarah wanted was something that belonged to the queen. So one night she crept into Charlotte's closet and took a ring, along with a miniature portrait of the queen in one of her finest gowns. Greedy for more, Sarah slipped in again the following night, but was caught. Stealing from the queen was a capital offense, and Sarah was duly sentenced to death. Fortunately, she was saved from the gallows through the intercession of Charlotte Vernon, a lady-in-waiting to Queen Charlotte, who had brought Sarah into the royal service. The death sentence was commuted to exile in the colonies. The redeemed maid arrived in the New World in the fall of 1771 and was sold as an indentured servant to William Duval of Bush Creek, Maryland. Life as a slave in all but name didn't suit Sarah, however, and after several months she escaped to Virginia. There she commenced her imposture. Somehow she had managed to keep possession of the items she had stolen from Charlotte, and she used them to create her new identity, Princess Susanna Carolina Matilda, the Queen's younger sister. Sarah told people she had been banished from court after quarreling with her sister, the Queen. No one seemed to notice or care that the supposedly German-born princess could not speak a word of the language, and the fact that Charlotte had only one older sister was apparently a non-issue as well. The one-time maid was feted in the American South by people eager to rub shoulders with royalty. The governors of Virginia and North Carolina warmly received her, and in both colonies, wrote historian Francis Xavier Martin in 1829, she made astonishing impressions in many places, affecting the manners of royalty so inimitably that many had the honor of kissing her hand. Yet while Sarah made her royal progress through the South, her master William Duval had not been idle. He advertised her as missing property and sent his lawyer to track her down. She was eventually captured in 1773, but escaped again 2 years later. By now the colonies were in revolt against Britain, and in the turmoil, Sarah was able to avoid detection. She eventually married a young officer named William Talbot and sailed with him to New York, where they raised a large family. In the midst of this simple domesticity, however, Sarah never forgot her stint as a princess. On the wall of her home, she kept a portrait of her imagined sister, the Queen.
You've been listening to Michael Farquhar reading from his new book, A Treasury of Deception, Liars, Misleaders, Hoodwinkers, and the Extraordinary True Stories of History's Greatest Hoaxes, Fakes, and Frauds, published by Penguin Books. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beatty is our producer, and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thank you for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau, wishing you a happy Valentine's Day.